From Utah Public Radio, this is Undisciplined. I'm Matthew LaPlante. The cover of David Maitland's new book is a kaleidoscopic image of brilliant blue starfish. Or at least that's what it looks like at first. But it's not what it seems to be. Instead, the star-shaped figures are the defensive hairs that cover the surface of a species of Japanese hydrangea, silhouetted against the leaf's chlorophyll-packed cells. In 2023, that image was the winner of the Plants and Fungi category of the Nature Photographer of the Year competition, and it's one of hundreds of images, many taken under a microscope, that Maitland has included in the book, which is called The Shape of Nature. Maitland is not just a photographer, he's also a scholar. He has a doctorate in zoology from the University of New South Wales, and in his book, he notes that the fact that certain shapes show up in many different ways in the natural world, from starfish to the hairs on the leaves of plants, helps us understand the hows and whys of the myriad ways life has evolved across the planet. By considering the relationship between form and function, Maitland says we can answer some of the questions of life's creation. Maitland is an internationally acclaimed nature and science photographer who specializes in small and microscopic forms. His academic research has focused on the form and function of living things, especially invertebrates, and his publication list includes papers on how maggots jump, crabs that breathe air with their legs, and asymmetry in the predation of trilobites. David Maitland, welcome.
Hello, thank you for inviting me.
David, other than the fact that your research interests were quite esoteric, you seem to have started out as sort of a normal academic with like journal publications on a bunch of different invertebrates, especially crabs. What got you interested in things that wear their skeletons on the outsides of their bodies?
I guess one of the first memories that I have, I grew up in St. Andrews in Scotland, right on the seashore there. I remember my mother always telling me, sitting on a beach, pulling the legs off crabs, poor things. And I've always been fascinated by crabs. I remember the movie The Vikings, I don't know if you recall that, where somebody is staked out on the rocky shore and all these crabs come out as the tide comes in and eats the poor man. And I don't know, that made a big lasting impression on me in terms of arthropods. And I mean, I never consciously thought what I would end up doing as a career. I just, when I was growing up, I was always interested in nature. I collected all kinds of bric-a-brac from the seashore and dead animals, had a skull collection, which I've still got, and just was just really captivated by the design of things, especially natural things. And that just led me on a career of first going to university to study zoology at St. Andrews University, and then on to do a PhD in Australia. And Australia was just mind-blowing. It was just the diversity of different, all kinds of weird and wonderful creatures that you'd only see in books, really.
Yeah, because like when you go to a place, like when you grow up around nature, which is fantastic and such a privilege, such a blessing. But then when you go to a place where nature is so different, where there's so many endemic species, it is just sort of a mind-blowing experience, isn't it?
Yeah, completely. I didn't know where to look. I mean, I was sort of overwhelmed. And I settled on studying crabs. And of course, in Australia, because it goes from the tropics all the way down to the sort of almost like the UK, really.
In terms of latitudes, you mean?
Yes, in terms of latitudes. So in terms of temperature, and what, you know, the temperature of the water, the sort of vegetation, the general habitat. And you've got these crabs which lived on land, which completely blew me away. In fact, one of my first experiences was going with a colleague in the zoology department at the University of New South Wales to, they called it the Back of Burke. And this was truly the outback and desert. And yet, on this dried, sort of muddy riverbanks. I mean, no water to be seen. There were these sort of like little pyramids of mud capsules. And we were tasked with scraping the pyramid off. And then that revealed a little hole. And then you try and trace a lot of backbreaking digging. Because, of course, the mud was concrete hard. And if you dug far enough down this hole, about a meter deep, there was a crab at the bottom. And I just couldn't believe this.
Well, and you've observed this in your book, too, that there's so many animals that have managed to do this, where they have, you know, partner animals, the tortoises and turtles, for instance, that like some exist on the land and some exist in the water. And it doesn't actually, you know, they're designed so similarly, and yet they've adapted to so many different conditions.
That's right. So the comparative approach is what I took very, very early on. I wanted to know why was this thing the same, but different, and so vastly different. And yet when you got your eye in, you could see that things were actually not as different as you might imagine. And the same principles just kept coming up time and time again, you know, the shapes of things. Spheres, stars, triangles, squares, hexagons. Of course, if you think of a beehive, the hexagons there, and then you start to think, well, where else have I seen hexagons like that? And the journey goes, you know, you see it in an unexpected place, and you wonder why is that?
And the fascinating thing here is that this sometimes happens as a result of a close common ancestor, a genetic mutation sometime deep in the shared lineage of species, but this also happens separate and moves toward this trait that is not necessarily in a shared ancestor. It's just a trait that makes sense in the context of nature.
Exactly. I mean, the beehive is a good one, and that puzzled most people interested in science and nature from an early age, I mean, Darwin included. And what's special about a hexagon, and of course it's all to do with the surface area that the hexagon bounds. If you wanted to enclose a space and you wanted to use as little material as possible, then a hexagon is the way to do it. The only thing that beats a hexagon, of course, is a sphere. Circle, but the problem with that is that you can't pack circles quite so conveniently together into a sort of tile pattern, because of course if you look down at a circle and you put several circles, several oranges together, you've always got gaps in between, sort of star-like gaps, and that's a lot of space which the beehive manages to avoid.
When did photography come into the picture? You're making these observations about the world. You are seeing these patterns emerge again and again. You're fascinated by them. Did you start taking photos to support science and those observations, or did you start science to support your habit of taking photos? Is it a chicken or an egg here?
I started taking photographs first, and my father had a cine camera, a Bolex, an old wind-up clockwork thing, and I was fascinated by these moving images. But what captured me more than anything else was that when we were sort of screening these flickery films on a white piece of bed sheet, in fact, I wanted to pause the projector and look at a single frame. And that single frame, you know, I would probably wrecked the film by doing that. But I paused it just at the spot where I just thought, wow, if I could just capture that image. And so that turned me on to still cameras. And my first camera was a Box Brownie that I bought from a jumble sale with pocket money. And those, you know, that took photographs, but they weren't particularly good quality. But I persevered with that, and I was always wanting to get as close as possible as I could to my subject, and I've never stopped doing that. I always want to literally be on top of it, and magnify the details, and it's those details that really captivate me.
Yeah, a lot of the images in your book are under magnification, and we'll talk about that more, but even images of like mammals, right? There's this image, this stunning image of an ape, and it's just, you're just right up close to its eyes. You always want to be very close.
Yeah, always. When I'm out in the field, I mean, people call me an animal whisperer. I wait, and animals will come to you if you just sit and wait. You don't move, you just watch, and you'll be amazed. It's usually an inordinately long time that you have to wait. But if you just patiently wait, the most incredible things can come towards you that you just would never have thought otherwise would be possible. I used to take groups of people out into jungles, sort of tropical, right around the equator. And the most people who have never been in such an environment would tell me, but there's never anything to see. And I would say, well, it's because they've seen you before you've got there. And if you just pause and look around, it's incredible. If you're with somebody who can actually see things, because there is a skill in actually seeing something that other people can't see.
That skill is about seeing patterns too, isn't it? I mean, like being around it enough that you get used to the patterns, and then, you know, the human brain is this magnificent thing that can identify differences in those patterns. Once the patterns are set in, but you have to spend some time adjusting to what the pattern is.
That's right. I mean, I often find myself laughing out loud in the tropics. I remember being in Tobago, and I think most people in America will be familiar with green iguanas, and they can be very, very large lizards that like to sort of drape themselves across the branches of a tree. But when they're babies, they're the most spectacular green color, so green that you just can't believe that anything can be so perfectly green. And of course, when they're that color, when they're in the vegetation, they're almost exactly the same sort of tone and hue of the green leaves around them, and you can't see them. And I remember being like literally almost inches away from a baby green iguana, and it wasn't moving, and I didn't see it at all, even although I was looking right at it. And it's that kind of wow that just keeps you going.
It's fascinating to hear you talk about the green iguanas like that, because you had a similar experience with a pit viper once. Same color, same brilliant, beautiful, amazing, almost hard to imagine green.
Yeah. I mean, it's the kind of green that if you could just capture, you know, I mean, if I was an artist with paints and things, I would want to somehow capture that. But of course you can't, because living things have all sorts of other clever little tricks going on in the way they produce color, which are to do with the shape of crystals of pigment and the way that the skin reacts under the influence of the nervous system and such like, so that they can match their environment almost perfectly. Chameleons are the perfect example of that.
It sounds to me like you were very much wired to have a camera in your hand. But I am wondering, you know, you had gone down this path of being, you know, a more formal academic. When did you wake up and say, you know what, I could be a photographer. That could be my main job in life.
Yeah, it was in Australia. You know, my passion for taking photographs. I mean, you asked earlier on, you know, which came first, the photographs to sort of explain science, or the science to explain the photographs. I would say it was the second, science. I wanted to learn about the things that I was seeing, and I can't separate those two things. Those two things are forever bound to each other. Photographs, I mean, they're a lot better today than they used to be, but the photographs that illustrated scientific articles tended to be pretty unimaginative in terms of any sort of creativity. They didn't go beyond the pure descriptive aspect of, you know, what is it that we're talking about in this paper? And so plonk, there it is, there's a picture. And of course, a picture speaks 1,000 words, so it's ideal. And of course, photography grew out of science effectively. And so for me, I just wanted to, if I was going to show a photograph of a crab, I wanted it to be the best photograph that I could take, so that even if you weren't really that interested in crabs, you might look at the photograph and think, whoa, I never knew they were so beautiful. And I didn't know they were so beautifully colored or such amazing shapes or that behavior that they do. I had no idea. And so it might make somebody think twice and go and look for themselves.
You mentioned always having this impulse to get closer and closer. When did microscopes come into play for you in this effort to get closer and to capture those images?
Yeah, you'd have thought that it would have been immediate, wouldn't you? No, I started off with just conventional macro photography, you know, a lens that could sort of focus a little bit closer than a normal lens. And that satisfied me for a long time. And of course, when I did zoology at the University of St. Andrews, the degree was very traditional and a lot of taxonomy. And microscopes figured massively in that degree. And of course, you had what we used to call spot exams, where you'd have a row of microscopes on a bench and some slide that was supposed to be interesting, and you had to identify the slice of some poor animal. And I just remember that these were always sort of blobs of red, you know, like in it was a section of a worm, an earthworm or something. And you had to sort of identify the nerves or the gut. And I mean, these things just turned me right off. I'm sorry I had to say that, but it's true. And then, of course, when they were talking about microscopes, they always talked about the technicalities of it. You know, oh, you've got to worry about the resolution. You've got to have diaphragms and condensers and all of this. And it just turned me right off, to be honest, that all that technical side of things. And so it was not until probably when I did quit academics to go professional in terms of photography. And the reason why I wanted to do that was that I wanted to improve my skills, and I couldn't devote enough time to practicing how to get the art out of the subject, you know, the lighting and all of the artistry that I wanted. So when I first quit academics, I remember seeing there was a gentleman who's now unfortunately passed away, and he mounted diatoms on slides, and he made these incredible patterns that you just wouldn't believe that these things existed.
Can I cut in there, because like this is, I'm glad you said that, because one of my favorite photos in this book is of these diatoms in the one in the greens and tans and gold. You said it, the image reminds you of a circuit board. To me, it's like, it's like a brilliant wallpaper pattern or textile design. I like seriously want a shirt made out of this design. And I was wondering, like, what makes you think that some things are so pleasing to the human eye? Like, what do you think evolutionarily is driving my concept and yours too, apparently, that this thing, these diatoms, are aesthetically pleasing?
It's an instinct that we have, isn't it, for, I mean, beauty. There's a huge debate on in science and philosophy or whatever subject you want to pick about what is beauty. And people still can't put their finger on what defines something that's beautiful. There are things that are beautiful to everybody, but then there are things that are beautiful to one person, but ugly to another person. And then in biology, natural selection, the selection of a mate, is down to one, you know, like a male choosing a female or a female choosing a male. And you've got a peacock with its massive, you know, the male peacock with its massive feathers, tail feathers, which have been shown to be attractive to the female. And the female is choosing a male on the basis of your tail is way more impressive than that cat next door's tail. And we have a word for that, which is beauty. What a peacock hen says, I don't know, but it's that aesthetic, isn't it? That the diatoms, their shells are made of glass, literally glass, and it's just hard to imagine that something, it's a single-celled creature that's halfway between being a plant and an animal, and it makes this exquisite, transparent shell around itself, which is just, it's not even just plain sheet, you know, it's pitted and shaped, and it's got facets and extensions, and they just come in a myriad of shapes and sizes, all microscopic. So unfortunately, you do need a microscope to be able to really appreciate them. But once you've seen them for the first time, you're smitten, I can tell you.
We often tend to get smitten over symmetry, or our perception of symmetry, at least. We find this to be visually pleasing. And this also isn't just a human or mammalian trait. It's found all over nature, from spiders to snakes to butterflies to plankton. What function does symmetry serve?
It is a very, very, I mean, we do it ourselves. You know, if you want to make a chair with four legs, you don't want it squint. And so you want to have something that is perfectly symmetrical. We have to ignore the fact that you do get chairs with three legs, but there's something going on there. It's a triangle formed by the base. But if we go back to the symmetry of a chair, its function is impaired if it's not perfectly symmetrical. And that's a fairly sort of obvious thing, I think. But in nature, for animals choosing mates that are perfectly symmetrical, and they definitely do. So swallows, we call them barn swallows here. They're a beautiful little bluebird that flies in the summer with long tails. It's like a forked tail.
It's these beautiful long split tails. Sailors get them tattooed on their bodies often, or used to at least. Yeah,
exactly. And it's been shown well shown, you know, by science studying these things in great detail, that males with slightly imperfect symmetry of their tail feathers can't fly quite as well as individuals with perfectly symmetrical tail feathers. And so that means that they can't maneuver, you know, they can't take that sharp bend to catch that fly midair nearly as successfully as another one that can turn more sharply. And so that would have an impact on its fitness in terms of being able to pass on genes that make, you know, the species better able to catch flying insects, which is what their main food is. And then on the other aspect, you've got the genetics, in terms of if you wanted to make something, then it makes a lot of sense that if you have to make two of the same thing, that if you make one perfectly, and if you just make the other one exactly the same as a direct copy, you actually, it turns out that you only require much less genetic material to program that, because of course you're making a copy. And I think everybody who's made an IKEA or other, you know, flat pack furniture would know that, you know, the first one that you make so many mistakes, and it takes you forever, all day if you're lucky. And then if you've got two of them to make, the second one is like a breeze in comparison. And then if you've got three of them, well, then the third one, you're an absolute expert.
And so symmetry is efficient. It's genetically efficient.
Yeah, very efficient.
That's David Maitland. He is a zoologist, a photographer, and the author of The Shape of Nature, The Intricate Patterns of Life, which you can find at or order from your local bookseller. And we're not done with David. We are going to continue this conversation next week, diving deeper into an exploration of form, function, and beauty in the natural world. Undisciplined is a production of Utah Public Radio. And if you happen to live in Utah, you can listen to us on UPR every Thursday morning at 10:30. If you're not in Utah, you can still listen to every episode of Undisciplined wherever you get your podcasts. Public radio stations around the country have had a substantial cut to funding. So now more than ever, it's important to support this work if you are able. You can do that at donate.nprstations.org/UPR. Our producer is Reagan Edelman. Our theme music is Little Idea by Benjamin Tissot. And I'm Matthew LaPlante. Thanks for listening. Now go have big ideas.